I'm Marshall Ganz. Welcome to Faces of Change, a podcast series from the Leading Change Network, in which we talk with people who practice leadership by organizing others to work together to build the power they need to win change their communities want. Before we get started, I'd like to take a few moments to reflect on the coronavirus, an urgent challenge that is teaching us all what urgency really feels like. We hope that everyone, their families, their friends are well and safe. Perhaps not surprisingly, our response to the calls for social distancing throughout the world has at the same time created a great need for relational proximity, connecting with each other to confront moments of challenge like this one. Those of us fortunate enough to have access to face-to-face technology like Zoom have begun finding creative ways to do this online. So it's an opportunity and a responsibility for those of us with organizing experience to learn to share our skills, our experience, and our leadership with others who are in need of these skills at this moment. Today, I'm joined by Mariali Cárdenas, the co-founder of Via Educación, a creative civil society organization on a mission to empower children and youth across Mexico to become effective community leaders and active participants in making democracy work. Mariali leads a team of organizers and educators who've introduced an approach to teaching democratic skills that isn't based on textbooks, but allows teachers and young people to engage in the practice of organizing on issues relevant to their lives at this moment. This approach has been successful. It's been adopted by Mexico's national curriculum. Mariali began her journey working with indigenous communities in northern Mexico and had the opportunity to come to the Harvard Graduate School of Education, which is where we met and began to work together, after which she returned home to launch Via Educación, which has now grown to a team of 90 organizers across the country. We started our conversation talking about why young people are receptive to organizing for change in their communities.
When I was at Harvard, I never really saw what we could do with organizing and children. I didn't see that connection like immediately. But as long as we have worked with them, I see every day that even children are capable of organizing. And I've listened to their voices and I see what they do. And I think that the potential of organizing goes in many dimensions, not only like in community settings or with adults, but with children, it has been wonderful, Marshall.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that children in general, they have wonderful ideas, but in an adult-centric world, yeah, we don't have the time or the patience to listen to those ideas.
Yeah.
So maybe sometimes they keep them to themselves or they never do something about them. And when we have given them the space to discuss their ideas, to talk about democracy, yeah, justice, and to see what they want to improve in their own environment, and they connect idea and then another idea and then they want to get others involved and they're so excited. And you see all the like the tools of organizing, all the first they start to get to know each other. Yeah. And then we have them when we work with them in the methodology that we developed, including the organizing strategies, yeah, and tools. We see how they start to empower themselves and become leaders and understand what their values are and what their power is. And yeah, and other children start to connect to that as well. And they start when we allow them as teachers or as adults, they start to put things on practice and they teach us a lot of lessons. For example, they know how to respect rules. This is something that gives teachers a lot of uncertainty. What will happen if we, you know, we're going to lose control? Yeah. This example of the rules, when we open the dialogue and ask them, well, we think the rules are set because they're good for everybody. And what do you think? And they say, well, but we think that this rule is not as good as you say. Okay, let's talk about that.
Now, how old are the kids we're talking about?
Well, from 6 years to 12, more or less.
Yeah.
So they start to deliberate and they start to say, well, maybe it's because you think it's important. And why do you think it's important? So, and this dialogue comes back and forth, and somehow they understand that it can be good, not for them, but also for the community, and they accept their role. They're happy with that. And if, but we have to be very coherent. If we see that actually that role is not something that it's improving their own conditions, then we are, capable of making a new rule. We, as adults, we allow the framework of the community or of the school to change that rule in order that the children see that it's something meaningful and good for everybody.
It's so interesting because you've been talking about how, you know, we create the space and allow the children or encourage the children to do these things. You also must be modeling just in the way you do what you're doing, no? They must be observing. In other words, if you were to do that and then act in a way that was completely contrary, that's what would register, probably.
Yes, Marshall, you're talking about something very important. We always are very dedicated to have genuine participation, not a simulation of participation or a manipulation, even worse, of participation. We really try to work with teachers to allow the space for dialogue and to have this participation genuine.
And you were just using the word dialogue. I mean, this is real kind of dialogue, because the teacher is also learning as the learner. I mean, it really is reciprocal. This is so cool. This is wonderful. I mean, today, Vía Educación is what, part of the national curriculum?
Yes. Well, we started working first with a small group of teachers because 8 years ago, more or less, the public system, education system, had to include again the civic and ethics subject because it was taken away from the curriculum, and then they wanted to introduce it again.
Well, we should have that here. Big time.
Yes. And teachers needed training because they weren't prepared before because it was something new. And we had some evaluation done of our work previously with a small number of schools. Well, it was 60 professors here and 60 in another state, and we did a comparison, quasi-experimental study to see the impact of our methodology, to see if actually it developed civics and citizenship skills in children. And we had the evidence just, you know, finished. Yeah. And so the Ministry of Education asked us to give this training to the new teachers that were going to teach the new assignment of civics and ethics. And we started here in Monterrey, but that it's an urban, large city. But at the same time, we tested the methodology in other contexts. So we went to Chiapas, and now we continue to work in the Tarahumara region, that is a northern region, indigenous region of Mexico. And we were so happy to see that the teachers, and the children had the same potential, even that they were in difficult or more difficult conditions. They could do something with that methodology. And then we were asked to design the renew or the reformed assignment of civics and ethics. So in the new subject, the methodology and the concept of genuine participation is within the national curriculum.
What is the basic approach that you've been able to get them to actually accept?
That we need to teach not only concepts, but we need to teach skills. And the way that we teach skills is by doing things, not just, for example, in the old textbook, there was an activity about dialogue. And it said, what is dialogue? Write the definition of dialogue. Okay, next activity. So it was nonsense.
Yeah, now, it's all conceptual. There's nothing experiential.
Exactly. We have because the children start to doing a project with when they start the school year. So we attach the concepts to the process.
Yeah.
So it will be more meaningful.
Well, it's just so fun. I just got through reading this article from last year on the Academy of Management Journal about why they've been studying how leaders articulate the vision of their company or whatever it is. And they distinguish between the ones who do so conceptually and the ones who do though experientially. Mm-hmm. And the conceptual is sort of like, you know, big words and this, and the experiential is visual. I mean, mm-hmm. concrete visual of actually seeing it. And they've tested this out now in several different settings, and it works.
And considering the differences of children, because I think that we have children like that, children yeah. that, when we talk about participation, we ask teachers to find a way with the children that they can participate, especially yeah. with their own talents, and not impose some sort of activities for those yeah. kids that want to, but everybody has to participate in the way that they decide, but they have to participate, be part of that change.
Yeah, I want to go back to where you started out. So mm-hmm. did you grow up in Monterrey?
I grew up in Saltillo, but it's a city near Monterrey.
Oh, Rosita Alvarez.
Yes.
That's right.
Not a happy story.
Very sad. El barrio de Saltillo.
Yes, I'm from Saltillo. It's a beautiful place and with many traditions.
Actually, what did your folks do there?
Well, my parents, they work in the field of counseling and education as well. They're academics. But when I was young, you know, in Saltillo, it's a city that is famous also for the tiles, the floor tiles. That it comes from the like little rivers, and they bring the dirt.
Clay
tiles, yes.
Yeah.
So in Saltillo, they make these tiles made out of clay, but I didn't know where they made them. And when I was in high school, they took us to a voluntary project in the communities where they actually made these tiles. And I had to work with children there. But I remember the first time that I went there, even that it was my own city that I had lived there for many years, I saw the poverty that was there because, these communities, as usual, they have lack of services. So there was garbage everywhere and the smell, and the conditions were very harsh. And I remember getting out of the bus that took us, and I said, I'm never coming back. It was very hard for me to see children in, you know, without shoes and running in the dirt. And but after an hour or a couple of hours that we were there, I also saw the smile of the kids. Mm. I also saw their happiness, their willingness to learn with the simple activities that we took them and the games.
How old were you then?
I was 16. 16. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I actually, our school also provided the opportunity to go to, in Holy Week, to go to the mountains and work with peasant families.
Yeah.
But only the people that worked in the community projects in the city could go there. So that connected me to another reality that was the mountains. And that really was the point where I felt this is what I want to do all my life. Because
when did you first go to the mountains?
The same year.
The same year
in maybe March or April. I remember we had to first take a bus all night, then another bus, and then a train for 4 hours. And then at one village, we had to take a mule
really?
To go down deep the mountains. Yes, it was amazing. I went there for many years, maybe 10 years while I was studying high school and college. I continued to go every year. But at one point, I was in this very lovely village in the bottom of the mountains. And I went to visit a family, and the lady gave me a glass of water, and I was drinking the water, and I turned my eyes to the mountains and the sky. And I told her, this is wonderful. It's wonderful to live here. And she said, well, why don't you come to live here? And I said, well, no, I have a job at home. And because I had just finished college, I was working at the university. Yeah. And but she left something in my head. And when I came back, I said, no, this is not what I want. I want to go back to the mountains. So I resigned my job. And I went as a volunteer for 1 year to those
really?
Mountains. Yeah.
And when, how old were you when you did this?
I was 23, maybe, finishing
23.
College. Yeah.
So I'm just trying to track this a little bit. So 16 is the first trip to the barrio, where they're making the
barrio. Mm-hmm.
And then it's also to the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And the mountains is during Holy Week.
Yes.
And was your faith active for you? I mean, when you grew up, I mean, you went to Catholic school, but was it a real thing for you, or was it just something you did?
I think it was just something I did, but I did have a deep belief that maybe came from the traditions of my family.
Yeah.
My grandmother talked about the Cristero stories and
Mexico. Wait, was she from the Cristero revolt?
Yes.
Yeah.
She didn't participate actively, but she was very supportive of the movement.
Yeah.
And she talked about stories how they had to hide their faith because they were persecuted, and
yeah,
how she got married at 5 a.m. because that was the only time that...
Really?
Yeah, and suddenly somebody, tapped the door, knocked the door, and everybody hid it, but it was only the milkman. It wasn't... And she had a big influence in my life as a person, a very coherent and moral person, and social as well. She created a place, a shelter where people could come to find clothing. And she worked there until she was 86 or something.
Oh.
And my father also, he has a very practical faith, very deep rooted as well, and very practical, but nothing dogmatic or you know. So when I think that was the seeds of my own faith, and when I went to the mountains, it connected my commitment to help others with my own meaning of my sense of what I wanted to do in my life.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very, it's actually very moving. I, your grandmother sounds like she was very cool.
Yes, she's wonderful. I still think of her because she had 7 kids, and now I have 2 kids, and I think how did she do that?
Yeah, no kidding. No, what do you think was it that was feeding you, calling you so much?
I think it was the potential of the people. I their humanity, their capabilities, but I was very concerned about the conditions that surrounded them, that didn't allow them to become whoever they were meant to be.
Yeah.
So that's why after a year of being there, it was nothing romantic as maybe before, because I got to see on firsthand many very difficult situations with violence and with sicknesses and many things. So I thought, I don't have the tools. I don't know what to do. But I need to learn what to do. And I was very interested in Paulo Freire, and I saw that Paulo Freire was a teaching professor in the School of Education at Harvard.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to go to the School of Education to learn more about critical thinking in education. When I went there, it wasn't very easy to find this line of thinking anymore in the School of Education. But there was some sort of movement around changing the world. So I saw another perspective. While I took a class regarding Paulo Freire's life, and that really was, it has been, and it is very important in my pedagogy still now. But at the same time, I saw like the other perspective of policy and of scaling projects and programs and education. And I took your class, Organizing People for Power and Change. And this gave me like a connection of different ideas, and it gave me a lot of light to see what I wanted to do afterwards. But still, it wasn't like an immediate process, because I remember one time I was writing a paper or something, and I thought about the children that I had worked before, a year before. And I thought about them, you know, bringing the wood for the fire in the morning and carrying the water and not having enough food to eat and lack of teachers and textbooks. And I thought, really? Can we really do something with these kids? I mean, the conditions are so harsh. And I was a little bit disappointed and maybe even started to lose hope.
Yeah.
And but somehow I realized that even that the conditions affect the children, they were capable of affecting those conditions as well.
Well, when did you see that? When did that fall into place for you?
Well, I was thinking about these theories or policies. I had in my mind the name of the people that I had worked before.
Exactly.
So I was connecting. And first, I can tell you that I wasn't happy about the macro level approaches, top-down approaches. I wasn't happy about that. That discomforted me a lot because I felt that it was a little bit disconnected from the humanity of the people. And but later on, I think that there is some, if we can have this dialogue, we can find strategies to have our projects scale and affect a larger group of people.
No, I think that kind of mutual, it's sort of insider-outsider. It's kind of that kind of, you know, I've always been a fan of Moses because, you know, he's the Jew who was an Egyptian. He was of the oppressed, but raised in the house of the oppressor. Mm-hmm. And of course, it poses a big problem for him initially. His rage takes over. But then eventually, after 40 years and a visit with God, he sort of puts it back together. But it's important that he sees both realities. And that's, I think, true of social movements generally, and often the leadership, people who make change, is an intimate connection with the, you know, the everyday reality and the pain of it. Mm-hmm. But also this opportunity to go on a mountain and see where it fits into other valleys and other places. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It sounds like that's what you had a chance to do. I mean, both were your choice. I mean, because your choice to go to the mountains, I don't imagine a lot of your peers did that, did they?
No, not a lot of people.
No. So you came here, mm-hmm. and you were here for a year, and that's mm-hmm. when we met. And mm-hmm. then you went back.
Actually, I came back to Mexico. I worked with a very large project in indigenous communities, 5 indigenous communities in the state, in different
in
states.
In Nuevo León or?
No, in Oaxaca, in Chiapas, in Tarahumara region, and in the Nahuatl region, and Mayan region as well. It was with Tec de Monterrey. It was a project that I wanted to create these community centers and work with people in the community so they could have access to technology. And after that, I came back to Harvard with my husband, with Armando, because that's when he wanted to study. And at that time, that's when we got together with other colleagues from the School of Education. And we had many informal conversations like everybody has when we're studying there. And we decided to keep in touch when we went back to our countries. So we conformed this sort of network that was called Via Educación. We were around 10 of us, yes. We were all very interested in citizenship, in democratic citizenship, and that type of ideas. And we wanted to do work together, but three of us were from Mexico, Armando, Emmanuel, and I, myself. And we were in the same area in Mexico. So when we came back, we formalized Via Educación as a nonprofit organization so we could start doing projects regarding citizenship education.
So how did that start? How did you start that? What actually happened?
I started working in a school directly with children. I wanted to test all these theories that I had read before about participation and children's participation. I had like the framework regarding genuine participation, Roger Hart's framework, but I wasn't sure how it could be applied actually in a school or within school level. And when I came back, I started an action research project. So I had a couple of kids as a group, and I asked them, so what do you want to improve in your community, in your school? And I started observing what their thoughts were and if they were actually able to participate. And so I followed up with them. And at the beginning, and the teachers were a little, you know, like, uncertain that it would work and what was going to happen, but they saw that they had good ideas and the projects were interesting. And I started to do these cycles of the whole year of being with them and having them really do something about their community. So I started to listen to the ideas of the children and how to develop the project that could improve the conditions of their school. And it was very interesting because at the beginning, the kids weren't used to being asked, what do you think or what do you want? But very quickly, I saw how they wanted to participate and how they did have ideas and they wanted to put them on practice. So I just followed their ideas using a simple action research cycle of observation, finding a problem, planning a solution, and execution of the project and the evaluation. And they started a project. They wanted to improve the restrooms of their school. That's what they found that was more important for them. They were from an underprivileged school, and they had problems with the restrooms. So they thought that this was something very important to solve.
Very real,
And they organized their classmates and the rest of the children from the school. They talked to the principal and to the teachers, and they really didn't understand why kids were asking these questions. They trusted me, so they followed what the kids said. And they actually mobilized the community so they could have better and cleaner restrooms in the school. At the end, they achieved what they wanted. And I guess it was a simple project, but I saw the potential in the kids. So that was something that started to make sense. I saw how they did have ideas and they wanted to implement them. And their motivation is amazing. They were so eager to join into action and to get others to join as well into their project. After several cycles of this type of work with the kids.
Just on the bathroom campaign. No, it's interesting because there was a youth organizing project here in Boston in the high school.
Mm-hmm.
That was their topic too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's right there. Yeah. Do you remember any particular moments in that initial campaign? The teachers must have wondered what was up. And as you say, they trusted you. So there was space. The kids. I'm just curious because it's sort of so out of normal expectation on everybody's part.
Mm-hmm. And everybody's, then, even in the children.
Oh, yeah, because they're being told or not being paid attention to or listened to. It's children have a natural curiosity, and it's just like we do such a good job of suffocating it rather than fanning the flames and encouraging it. And that's kind of what you were doing, I think.
And we have a criteria. When they had to choose their project, they had to find something something that was good, not for only one person, but for the community. Something that was under the rules of the school.
Yeah.
So they discarded having three recesses. You know, that was one of the options as well.
Yeah.
And another is that they were the ones that were going to do it. That was another of the criteria. So this guided them to decide what they wanted to do. And it was a nice project because they had to work together with the people that actually were responsible of cleaning the restrooms. And they organized a meeting with them because they had to dialogue with them. And they brought the people from the cleaning service. And the ladies were so angry. You guys leave everything, you know. You're so dirty kids, and you know, like that. And the kids, yeah. We know. No. But you have to be more, you know, do this and tell your classmates, and we do our best. Because they felt like threatened. They thought they were being accused that their work wasn't good.
Yes.
But the children managed the dialogue, and at the end, they were hugging each other. We're going to do this together, and this is going to be okay. They joined like in the team, and they had their fellow classmates, you know, be cleaner what they were had to do. But they also, I think they started. They asked the principal if they would allow them to sell candies in the recess so they can earn money to paint the doors that were all, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And so they helped with some resources to improve physically the restrooms as well, and work with their classmates to, well, have a better cleaner habits, and with the people that clean the restrooms also.
What's neat is, you know, it's... trivial and simple are not the same thing. Simplicity can be fundamental to actually being able to do something, which doesn't make it trivial. It makes it clear. And you know, there's for them to actually have the experience, it's not going to be electing the new president of Mexico. It's going to be dealing with a real problem that they can exercise some agency with respect to other people about. That makes it deeply simple, not shallowly simple, I think.
That's the core. That's the main objective of this. Yeah. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, so then Marcia. What happened?
We started working like this with the kids in several cycles of other projects as well. And then I started to write down like the steps in the form of a methodology that the kids could follow and that the adults or the teachers could guide them. Mm-hmm. And very important, not using manipulation or simulation, but genuine participation, truly genuine participation. There's some critics about this sort of work with children and their participation because some people say, no, don't turn them into adults so soon. You know, why are you making them responsible? But what we see is that they're actually participating and they're actually, many of them are even burdened with, for example, environmental care.
Yeah.
Children are so aware of that and not having the abilities or the skills to do something about it locally within their own school or community is something that I don't think it's good. I think that they have to have the skills and see in their level and their capabilities, see that they're capable, able of doing something about it.
There's this concept called moral injury that was developed by Paul Shea here, who works with veterans, actually, where he was saying that when it's not just if you participate in something that's contrary to your moral framework, but you can also, if you observe it and don't do anything or can't do anything, it can create a real problem. It can create a kind of passivity or rage. And so you need to act in order to be able to, you know, kind of sustain a certain kind of moral coherence. When you were describing, well, the kids care about this, they care about this, they care about this, but then they're told you can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. It inflicts a kind of, I don't know if you'd call it moral or political injury, but a kind of, you're teaching, they're learning passivity. They're learning lack of capacity. Mm-hmm. They're learning loss of agency. Mm-hmm. And you're flipping that around.
Exactly. They learn despair. For example, my son, he had a talk in his school about water, and he was so worried that we wouldn't have water the next day that he couldn't go to sleep at night. But then that's exactly, we have to flip that and tell them and help them to develop these skills in practice, in action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, this is so neat. So keep going. So then what happened?
We wrote this methodology and we tested it in a larger scale, like I was saying, this quasi-experimental research project with teachers from Guerrero, that it's a very different socioeconomic condition than Monterrey, Nuevo León.
Yes. Acapulco.
Acapulco, yes, near Acapulco and Chilpancingo.
Yeah.
And we saw how even in conditions that were even more difficult than the ones in Nuevo León, the methodology worked. I think this is as important as reading and writing and maybe math, knowing that you can do something about that reality that surrounds you and giving that hope to them.
Yeah, amen to that. I mean, that's a problem. It's a challenge everywhere. It really is. And it's so interesting. I mean, you're engaging with it really, really at the real grassroots. It's funny. I just have this thing about people want to go to macro solutions. It's kind of like they want to compose Beethoven's Third Symphony without learning the scales. and it's built, if it's solid, it's going to be built the way that you're building, I think. Let me ask two questions. I mean, one is, what do you feel most satisfied about? But the other question is, what do you feel is most challenging now? But let's start with what you feel satisfied about.
I think what really has me happy about the work that we have done is to see other people do what we dreamed about. I wasn't able to do as much as I wanted by myself. But now looking at other teachers, other facilitators, everybody that has, you know, listened to the same thing that we wanted to do and that has incorporated in their own way of doing things, the work that we had done, I think that gives me a lot of satisfaction to see that our work has transcended more than we had ever thought and that other people are happy to use these tools that we developed and applying them.
So now what about the challenges?
I think about remember you taught us in your class, the spheres of power?
Oh, the three faces of power.
Face of power.
Yeah.
Many times I think about the more structural face of power. And, I try asking myself, who is benefiting about the lack of educational opportunities in the rural and indigenous communities? Yeah. Why is this so bad? And who is in charge of this? And how can we change it from the more structural perspective? So I think this is a challenge to understand the more complex situation of education in our country and find ways to approach that in a more structural way as well.
What are your thoughts? Yeah, I do. Because, you know, in the first face of power, there's, you know, the obvious first face, who wins, who loses, and the second face, who decides. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you've been making progress in both of those. But then this question of, well, wait a second, what about the taken for grantedness of the situation? And you're asking, well, okay, so where does the responsibility for this rest?
Exactly.
Go ahead.
We're in the mountains and we're teaching kids from, 13 years old that don't know how to read and write.
Yeah.
So how has our system allowed this, you know, and why? And I think that some of my thoughts are we have to mobilize the different actors around the problem.
Yeah.
Because everybody's working on their own side. Human rights on their own side, nonprofits, each of them with their own ideas separately, the government allowing this and benefiting somehow from this, the private sector not knowing how to alleviate the symptoms but not tackling the causes. So I think we are in a place that we could organize within these gatekeepers, you know, and follow some campaign, you know, and mobilize the resources, the values, the power of each other to solve this in a more structural way. This is what I'm thinking, Marshall.
No, I think, I love it that you're thinking this way because it has to go that way, doesn't it? I mean, if it's really, you know, it's kind of like here, there was a lot of treating of symptoms here in the United States. And it took Trump, Trump I think of as kind of like a boil, you know, where you get a boil and you lance it and all the poison comes out, but it's been there all the time. And so then sooner or later, these chickens come home to roost, as they say, and have to be addressed. And the question you're asking is a really important question. Somebody somewhere must be enjoying benefit from the fact that this is not being addressed. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess, how would you think of that? Well, people get stuck on the status quo when they benefit from the status quo and experience any change as problematic, especially if it has anything to do with power. Where do you see the power? In other words, who gets to hang on to power to the extent that so many young people are not getting educated?
Well, I think it's a moral problem, Marshall. I think that people are not they're not understanding that what they're doing to have maybe more power or more money in the wrong side of power and money, it's affecting so much the rest of the people in the community. I think it's, I can't point at someone specifically, but some sort of understanding, a collective understanding of if we do this, it's all right, and it's not a right.
Do you think it's that they don't know or that they don't care?
I think they don't care.
Yeah.
Well, probably there's people that don't know. Maybe, yes.
Yeah,
right. I mean, people that actually think that they're doing good because they're giving out maybe assistential benefits. But I know there are people that know they're not doing that.
So like then that. The question is how to get them to care, right? And you're describing it as a moral challenge, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's part
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the other way to think about getting them to care is sort of, you know, the classic organizing formula. How would it become more costly for them not to care?
I'm going to write that down.
No, I think it's so exciting because the foundation that you've laid is so, it's so well grounded from so many standpoints. I mean, certainly from any sort of an intellectual standpoint, from a performance standpoint, from a moral standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And at some level, people know that an educated public is part of the future. But of course, sometimes an educated public then wants to have voice that gets uncomfortable.
Yes, but it's a human right.
That's right.
And I think it's and at some point, even that they get uncomfortable, they can see that morally it's something important. And even like you said, we have to find the way that their interests are going to be affected. These people don't make good decisions, like electing a president that could actually help the country. You know? This is where their interests get affected as well. But there's so much work, Marshall, to do.
but you're doing it. What a great thing to do this and make it work. So how are you figuring out what the next step will be? What's your plan?
I guess we have to continue evaluating our results because this has been a source of getting people to understand the importance of what we do.
Yeah.
So we need to continue to prove the effects and the results and evaluate the projects and the programs. But I think what we were talking earlier, Marshall, about the larger scale of effect. And right now we were asked to advise UNESCO in the OSDGs in the...
Really?
Because there's I think it's... Objective number 4 is education, and the target 4.7 is regarding global citizenship and sustainability. So there aren't many ways to concretely, you know, develop these skills in kids. So we have been working with a team of Latin America to finding ways to... our approach is to have children's participation in developing global citizenship as well.
Well, this is neat. I'm really glad we got to do this.
Likewise, Marshall.
Congratulations on what you've accomplished thus far.
Thank you, Marshall. No, it's a work of many people of our team and yourself. Thank you for everything that you have taught us and continue to teach us, Marshall.
Thank you. Hasta la próxima.
Hasta la próxima, Marshall. Muchas gracias y un abrazo.
Thank you for joining us for Faces of Change with Mariali Cárdenas. If you'd like to learn the tools of organizing and lead change in your own community like Mariali, you can do this through the Leading Change Network. Go to the Leading Change website and you can learn more. Coming up next month, we meet Diana Jay, the co-founder and director of organizing of the Sunrise Movement, the high-profile movement of young people and their allies that's moving forward in the climate change justice debate in the United States, including catapulting the Green New Deal to the national debate on climate action. We'll hear how Diana was called to leadership in the climate movement and how Sunrise is organizing across the United States to build the power needed to address climate change. And I might add that the experience of the coronavirus has demonstrated the kind of mobilization that can make a difference, and in fact has already begun to reduce toxic levels around the world. So there's a lot we have to learn from the current challenge to deal with challenges like the one that Diana is leading on. So until then, keep healthy, keep safe, and join us next time.